Welcome to the Balanced Feminine Podcast. We are your hosts, Maddie and Katie.
This is a show centered on helping women find a balanced lifestyle that nourishes mind, body, and spirit. Hi guys, we are so excited. Today we are meeting with Lodro Rinsler. He is a meditation expert and he's going to give us a great deep dive into all things meditation and mental health and spiritual health. And we're just so excited to have him on. So welcome, Lodro.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
Yes. So we'd love for you to just go ahead and share with our audience a little bit about you and some of the key points that make you who you are.
Gosh, that's an interesting way of phrasing it. That's a bigger question, but I suppose this is part of it, which is I was raised in a Buddhist household in New York City. My parents had already been meditating and practicing Buddhism for a number of years before I came along. So it was just sort of in the air when I was growing up, and I started meditating when I was a baby, like 6 years old. Not because that was even pushed upon me, but just because that's when something like that is in the air, it's sort of like, oh, this is what we do. So I'm very fortunate in that regard to have sort of been immersed in these things from a young age, and then did meditation retreats in my like teen and preteen years, that I was able to sort of go and do longer retreats in my later teenage years, to the extent that I ended up being asked by some of my mentors to just go ahead and do a teacher training when I was a baby. I mean, still, I think... I was actually talking to someone the other night, being like, the older that I get, the younger I think of other people, which is a little obnoxious of me. But I was 18 at the time. So I was still forming as an adult, and yet at the same time was offering basic mindfulness instruction, and then have continued to do that for another 20 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So that's really interesting that you mentioned it kind of started off from such an early age. There was no influence from your parents as far as that was involved? Were they like pushing you to meditate, or did that something that kind of just came naturally and you were excited to do it on your own?
It's a great question. I mean, a little bit of everything. So I do think the view around why meditation was important, the view around holding oneself with a basic sense of confidence in your own innate goodness, as opposed to you're innately messed up. I mean, these were sort of formative things that were in the environment when I was growing up, but they themselves never said, hey, we think you ought to be meditating. And, you know, I often get questions from parents, particularly newer parents, asking exactly that, like, how do I get my kid meditating? My honest answer to them is often like, if you're meditating, if you're actually embodying these principles of mindfulness and compassion and kindness that come out of the meditation practice itself, yeah, at some point your kids are going to be like, I want to do that. And it was never this thing of like, you should just go do this because you need to fix yourself. Like that's, I think, sort of a not helpful mentality for many of us. Mm-hmm. But that sense of like, oh, I'm inspired because I see this around me and I see the benefits of it, then I want to go and pursue it because I want to feel that way. So it was more in that regard, I would say.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I feel like one of the best ways to get someone to kind of hop on your train is to just exhibit these things naturally. Like, don't force them onto themselves. You live it. It's your lifestyle. People will follow.
So. Yeah. And I think that's exactly it. I mean, for a lot of the work I imagine you do, it is that sense of like, if I'm actually doing it and people see that there is joy in this, there is kindness in this, there is presence, they want to be involved. There's no sale job there, right? It's just a sense of like, oh, you can join me in this, which just feels more holistic.
Yeah. So this is kind of I don't know if I'm asking this question the right way, but for people that aren't really familiar with meditation and what it does, how do you describe it to someone that's never heard of it, doesn't know what it is? Yeah.
It's a great question. a good definition of meditation is that we would be so much of our life is basically lost in discursive thinking. Well, what if this happens? And then we go over here and then we say, okay, well, what about this? And then we get distracted and there's something else. And it's sort of like we are constantly opening these tabs in our browser. It's like we never go and we X them out. There's just at the end of the day, 10,000 open tabs. I guess one analogy would be in meditation, what we're doing is just sort of acknowledging that, clicking the X button and coming back to the first page. So when we talk about meditation, we can meditate on the breath, we can meditate on sound, we can meditate on a mantra or phrase, but the idea is that we're substituting going off on those discursive thoughts for a solid object of our attention that we keep returning to. So a popular form of meditation that we often see these days is mindfulness meditation, which comes from the Buddhist tradition. That was, when I say I've been meditating since I was a very young child, that's what I was doing, which in the simplest form is just taking a relaxed and uplifted posture. That's step one. Step two is to notice how you're breathing, just following the breath, however it's flowing. And step three is when you get distracted by those discursive thoughts, you acknowledge them, you hit the little X button on the tab, you come back to the breath. And that's it. It's very simple, but not easy because we're so habituated to continuing to go into discursive thinking. So at first it's a little overwhelming for people to actually just get used to the idea of, oh, I don't have to chase after every thought. I can come back to the breath over and over again. But it's that, is meditation, whether we're looking at it in the Vedic tradition or transcendental meditation, where we are actually we're coming back to a phrase, a mantra, or something in mindfulness, like we're mindful of the breath, we're continuing to notice, oh, I'm drifting off and I just come back. And that's all it is. It's very simple in that regard.
It's incredible because, so I was in a coffee shop and I picked up this book and it was called A Buddha Walks Into a Bar. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I sat down and started reading a few pages and I was like, oh my gosh, this is really good. This is really interesting. And my boyfriend was sitting there across from me and I was like, you gotta read this. Like, this is incredible. And I'm someone that struggles like a lot with my thoughts are always coming and going like constantly. And I've started to implement a lot of like your practices and what you say in the book, just with like coming back to my breath. And I've seen it be able to help me recenter myself in that present moment. And then I've found that like the thoughts that I was obsessing about just fade away. They fade away. And then maybe they'll come back to me if it's important, but like it's really helped my presence in that moment. So
I'm so glad to hear that. And also, you know, it's always interesting just as someone who's written a handful of books on this topic to notice like, oh, this is something, I mean, what year is this? This is 2021. So I was writing this book, finishing it up in 2011. It's 10 years older. And here it is like being discovered and having a positive impact, which is so meaningful to me personally, because you never know where the, you know, you throw a stone in a pool of water, you never see all the ripples. It just continues to go out. So it's lovely. I'm so glad to hear that. And yeah, I think there's something to it where it's just, so I've written 7 books. The most recent is Take Back Your Mind, Buddhist Advice for Anxious Times, which is very much about the fact that we're living in very anxious times, very stress producing times. And how do we work with the mind? And in this one, I'm just more explicitly like, so listen, you can keep reading this book, but if you're not meditating, you're sort of missing the point. Like, okay, my words can be pleasant, but like, if you're not working with your own mind, then you're not going to see the benefit. And I love that you were like, okay, I pick up the book and I'm actually doing it. I'm going to apply myself to, I'm going to say the work, but it is, I mean, it sometimes feels like there has to be some effort. It's not the easiest thing to sit down and continue to carve out time of getting to know ourselves in a way that we wouldn't normally.
Absolutely. And that's, so I'm doing this 20-day challenge for myself. Like, it's like, no one's like told me to do it, but after reading your book, I'm like, okay, I can devote like 3, 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day to just like for myself, sit down and do this. And I'm really driven to see like where this helps overall in my life. And your book is very inspiring because it's like, you just like take that time for yourself and like, it's not going to happen overnight, but you will start to see it. And that's going to be, there's going to be a huge shift. And I think that's one of the biggest things for especially like for Maddie and I, our age, where we're at in our lives and our age. And like you were saying, like we are living in such chaotic times right now. And as young, like we're in our, like we're 27 and it's hard to find time for yourself in such a chaotic world. And I think it's so interesting because I was listening to a podcast that you were on and they were talking about how you would share that you grew up in New York City. And that is like so incredible to be able to find peace and calmness in such a, you know, intense city like that. So I think that if you can do it, then anyone can. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is an interesting one. There's this beautiful old quote by a Tibetan Buddhist teacher that's a couple hundred years old at this point, but the idea of like, you can go into a solitary retreat where there's nothing around for miles. And yet if you are not holding the mind of meditation, you might as well be in a bustling city. And yeah. It, the opposite can be said, where it's like, can we cultivate a mind of presence, a mind of mindfulness, that whether we're in a busy city, whether we are in a cabin in Wyoming, that we are actually like, I am able to work with my mind. And I think that's the thing that, as you were saying, so many of us are longing to do at this point. A lot of people come to meditation. Maybe people are listening to this right now and they're like, I can't meditate. I tried it once. You know, it doesn't work for me. And admittedly, like this is one of those frustrations as someone who's taught meditation for 20 years, because it's a rough equivalent of someone walking into a gym and being like, I don't know if I could sign up here. I worked out once and I didn't lose any weight. And it has that same thing where a lot of the work that I end up doing is just re-educating people around like, it's the exact idea that it's going to take you time before you see the benefits. The benefits are subtle but profound. Like no one's like, oh my gosh, I am 25% less stressed out than I was before. That's so noticeable. It's just that we gradually are like, oh, I'm not being so reactive. Maybe right. It's because I've been meditating. So it's the same thing here where it really is interesting that, you know, yes, you know, it could be cultivated in New York City. It could be cultivated in retreat, but this mind, it's like, we have to realize that our mind is workable. Right. It's not like this fixed thing that we are doomed to never be able to meditate, that we are doomed to always have an anxious mind. We are constantly making choices to either reify stress and anxiety in our life. And those decisions could be, you know, we get a angry email from our boss and we're like, okay, how much mental energy am I going to give this? Do I read it, acknowledge it, and then talk to them later? Or do I play out every possible scenario between now and then? That's our choice. No one's forcing us to hold ourselves in a state of stress about that, but us. So it's actually unlearning that tendency that's very easy to slip into and just continue to be like, I'm going to hold myself in a state of pain and say, I don't need to do that. And that's actually where meditation can become really helpful. So wherever we are, that's the thing. Yes, there's sometimes more external circumstances that are stressing us out. A pandemic.
Yeah.
Job stress, career stress, whatever. That's fine. But like the idea here, you know, one of my favorite, if we go to the dictionary definition of the word equanimity, is that it's mental calmness or composure, especially in the midst of difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. So whether that's difficult circumstances, you're at a fight with your spouse, or you have career woes, or you are in the midst of a busy city and there's just a lot of distraction, it doesn't matter. Like we could still actually cultivate a mind that's able to remain present and open in the midst of that.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, do you find that there's any forms of, I don't want to necessarily say meditation, but just along that line that you can take with you throughout your day rather than when you're just sitting in your still space meditating? Or is that more something where when you're really diving into these meditation practices that you just find more of an ease and a flow throughout your day? Or maybe it's both.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's sort of like, okay, if I go to the gym and I work out, there are other parts of my day where I just am more embodied. Mm-hmm. Where I am more sort of aware. I might even stretch a little bit because there's some tension, but it's because I've sort of put down a base that I sort of know how to work with the body at that point. So I would say the same thing can be really helpful with the mind. So on one hand, yes, 1,000,000% to your question. Like, yes, there are a lot of things that we could do, and I'll name a couple in a moment to work with the mind when we're not meditating. But it's really helpful if we have that foundation of working with the mind, because then those things become easier to do.
Yeah.
So it's the same idea. So for example, you know, I mentioned this sort of repetitive thinking that comes up when we're like, what does this boss want to talk to me about? What are they going to say? Well, what if they say this, then I'll say that. Maybe in the first couple of times we think about it, it's helpful because we need to schedule time with them or something like that. But after the 50th time, we could ask ourselves a simple question in our own head. Is this helpful? Is this useful? If the answer comes back from inside us, no, then that gives us more freedom and liberation to not continue to do that. Mm-hmm. So becoming gently inquisitive with our experience when we fall into repetitive anxious stories can be liberating. Another one would just be to take a couple deep breaths in through the nose, out through the mouth, 3 breaths, 7 breaths. You know, I share a story in the book, Take Back Your Mind, of this moment where it was sort of a perfect storm where I had like a couple of hours to move out of my old apartment, move into my then girlfriend, now wife's apartment. I loaded up the U-Haul by my lonesome, like miscellaneous calamities are happening. Someone wanted to have a last minute meeting with me. I'm driving. I hit traffic in this bridge in this giant U-Haul. Even like talking about it now, I'm like, the experience of being in like New York City traffic in a giant U-Haul is like, oh, you know, and then through and like you're late for the meeting and things like that. It's sort of the perfect storm for a nightmare. And I wasn't necessarily going to be able to just drop it all because my body was being really held in a state of stress. But to take 3, or in that case, I guess it was 7 deep breaths in through the nose, out through the mouth, took a long enough gap from the story of, oh, I don't know if I'm going to make it on time. Oh my gosh, is this traffic ever going to move? It took a gap long enough for my body to reset, my shoulders to start to sink back down, and for me to take a different approach. So things like that can actually be really helpful in conjunction with and built upon meditation.
Wow. I think it's interesting because in American culture, there's this like idea that like, if there's not scientific knowledge behind it, then like no one's going to really like, why do it? Why believe in it? But there's, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is like a lot of scientific, like studies that have come out proving that meditation does in fact like help the brain. Is there any ways that like you can tell us that it does, like what it does exactly?
Sure. Yeah. And similarly, I am not a scientist or someone who's even particularly good at neuroscience, but yes, is the short answer. Because there is a lot of research these days. It feels like every week there is some sort of study coming from Harvard, MIT, University of Wisconsin, wherever, that's saying if we meditate a little bit every day, 10 minutes a day, for example, is often a common point of study over a period of 6-8 weeks, that we see increased gray matter in the hippocampus. We see more activity in the ACC in the brain. And what these things mean for laymen like me is that we're less held in stress. And it's funny because I think that's basically the bottom line, but they will often measure it in, does this increase someone's ability to sleep better? Does this help boost their immune system? Does this increase creativity? There's all these very specific studies, but in my mind, if you're not held in a state of stress all the time, yeah, your body's going to be able to heal better. You're going to sleep better. You're going to have more space in your mind for creativity because you're not constantly telling yourself stories that are stressing you out. So I do feel like it also falls under that umbrella of stress reduction, even though there are so many specific benefits these days. I feel like we're a minute away from BuzzFeed releasing the 20 sexiest reasons we should meditate. Like it's just like a hit list or get shinier. And but we are at that point where I would be surprised if they start studying these things.
Yeah. I have a friend that, he was raised, like with the Buddhist teachings, and I'm good friends with his girlfriend. And I would always be like, I don't understand why he's so chill. Like why he, you know, he like his whole being, like his energy is just like great. And he's just always happy. And she's like, oh, well, his parents raised him to meditate all the time. And I'm like, okay, I need to hop on this train.
That's a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier though, right? That sense of like, yeah. I see the benefits there. It's not theoretical for me. I would like to embody that too.
Yeah,
exactly. I've seen that a lot. Yeah, over the years, you know, I've done a number of things. You know, I ran Buddhist nonprofits for a period of time. I ran a network of meditation studios called Mindful in New York City. And people would come in, regardless of where and how. And I would often be like, oh, you know, you're bringing your friend. How did you find this place? And what are you thinking? And they're always like, well, and my favorite example is this guy, Ethan, who was running a friend. She was like, he used to be sort of a jerk. And then we have lunch every Tuesday. And you know, I noticed that he started listening more. And he actually started following up on stuff they never would have before to see how he was doing, like caring more. And I was like, why are you like this? And he goes, I don't know. And she's like, well, is it because this meditation thing you've been doing? And he goes, maybe it's that. And it's that sense of like both a surprise and delight for him, but also that's why she showed up. She was like, there's actual change that comes out. And she saw it for herself.
Right. That's so powerful. You live by example. I was really curious because I heard you talking on a podcast about how you had, you know, lived this life of being a monk, and then you went from the other extreme to like going to college and doing keg stands. And I'm very curious about that, like what it was like to see and live both of the extremes. And if you could kind of explain, like in my head, when I think someone like living in the mountains in India and living this like very spiritual life. So it's interesting to hear someone say like, oh yeah, I was a monk and then I went to college. And so if you could kind of like tell us about that and your experience, that would be really interesting.
Sure. Happy to. So when I was 17 years old, I spent a short stint in a monastery an abbey in Nova Scotia, Canada. And this is not uncommon for people to try out ordination and see if that's life for them. And some people stick with it and some people are like, nope. I imagine it's that still be a program that's active. It's a great program that they're like, we will expose this to young people for a period of time and see whether it sticks. For me, I mean, I was 17. I came back, I finished up my last year of high school, went to college, and it was not something I wanted to actively pursue. Maybe someday, but I don't think it's the path for me. It's just a personal decision for many people. The interesting thing here, though, is while at the monastery, and remember, I'm a 17-year-old boy, and I'm like still like, ooh, this is an attractive nun next to me. Like, there's still the same sort of things happening in your mind, even though you're in a different place. It's a bit of a harder stretch because everyone has their whole 9 yards. But, you know, it's sort of like your mind is going to be your mind anywhere. You know, there's this great Saturday Night Live skit. Andy Sandberg? No, Adam Sandler. It was Adam Sandler who plays it's a commercial for his Romano Tours. People can look it up. It's delightful. It's 3 minutes long or something. And he's going on and on about all of these amazing tours where he's going to take you to in Italy and so on and so forth, all the beautiful things you'll see. He says, but there is one thing. If you're sad at home, you will probably be sad here. Coming here doesn't fix your life. You will still have the same mind when you're here. And I love that. It's just this truth of like, you know, we're always looking for the cure.
Right.
Well, if I go on this vacation, then I'll be happy. If I go get this job, then I'll be happy. And yet the mind's the mind. If we're not working with the underlying things that bring about happiness or sadness in our life, then yeah, we're going to continue to perpetuate those tropes. So, you know, a 17-year-old boy in a monastery, 17-year-old boy at a college, it's the same mind, right? It's just, you know, how much am I working with that mind? How much am I curbing tendencies that might be harmful to myself or others? How much am I actually emphasizing, trying to be of benefit to others? So I think for me, it's not like, oh, there was this time of great purity and then this time of great debauchery. It's like the mind is the mind. It's this sense of like, how do we continue as individuals to evolve, to grow in the midst of whatever circumstances we're at? You know, I think me at 38 is very different than me at 28, very different than me at 18. So it's just like, these are just different iterations. And yes, you know, like, 28-year-old me could go out drinking more than the 18-year-old me, and the 38-year-old me can't handle the drink that used to happen at 20. Like, these are things that just are part of life. And as a result, maybe the circumstances change, but my mind is my mind. Like, how am I holding it in relationship to alcohol? How am I holding it in relationship to my money? How am I holding it in relationship to my relationships? And there are times where one might be skillful, and there are times, in my case, where I've been unskillful. And that's part of it. So I think this is an interesting thing, not to be like, okay, then he evolved. Or like Lodra Rinsler at 38 is like the expert or the master or whatever. Like, I'm an evolving human being, and we can talk in 10 years. And I'm confident that your podcast will be flourishing even more than by then. And, you know, I'll probably have very different reflections on these things. But I think it's interesting for us to just say, how much am I evolving in ways that are positive and that I feel good about? How much when I fall down on the job, so to speak, do I pick myself up, learn from that, and say, I want to go in a different direction? And I think that's sort of an interesting thing that we, as meditation practitioners, as people on spiritual journeys, as a society, need to consider. Like, that we, it's not like, oh, these are the good people, these are the bad people. These are the people that, you know, are the pure people because they're the monastics or whatever. And these are the bad people who are, you know, doing kicks. It's sort of like, well, where are they and how are they showing up and how are they treating other people? And what are they learning when they're not treating people well and all of that?
Yeah, as I was reading your book, I remember thinking to myself, I was like, wow, I really wish that meditation had been a part of my life at a younger, I mean, you can't look back, but solely because having that intention around actions. And I feel like when you're in your teens and you're in your 20s, it's hard. You're in a very unknown phase of your life. And to be able to make choices, and especially when it comes to drinking and sex, and do it with intention, I think that certain areas of my life may have played out differently. And it's not to say like hindsight, like, or look back, but I do think that meditation, implementing it into kids at such a young age, would be highly beneficial, especially because I feel like we live in such a world that is, you know, there's so much chaos. So how do you come back to your intention and be still with your choices?
Yeah. And I think you just sort of named it, which is, oh, can we actually learn to live with more intention and not just sort of unconsciously fall into old bad habits? And that's the thing that meditation really does help provide to a certain degree, that it's like, oh, I can very well start to notice I feel good when this happens and I don't feel good when this happens. You know, when we're meditating, for example, we have bazillions of thoughts come up. This is the most normal thing in the world, that we have thoughts come up. And we might say, oh, I shouldn't have said that stupid thing last night to that person. And then we come back to the breath. Oh, they probably think I'm such a nerd. We come back to the breath. It didn't even make sense after we come back to the breath. At a certain point, we might say, I want to be more mindful of my speech. Like, if this is continuing to play out in that way, in this way at work, in this way in my romantic relationship, whatever it is, you say, oh, I want to actually start turning my attention to that, because this doesn't, the way I'm currently doing this doesn't feel good. And a good example of this would be gossip. A lot of people are like, ooh, gossip, I don't like to gossip. And then yet we often fall into the bad pattern of doing that sort of thing, talking negatively about others, particularly when they're not around. And the idea being like, oh, I could actually do something other than that. I actually need to become more mindful of my speech. There's a particular set of teachings in Buddhism that points out that there's a combination of things that happen here between body, speech, and mind. So body, in this case, being the activity of the body. The mind being what we actually hold in the mind. If I'm constantly talking negatively about other people in my mind, it is more likely to come out through my speech. If I'm constantly talking about people poorly, it's going to probably affect my mind and make me wonder if they talk negatively about me when I'm not there and things like that. So a good example of the body part would be that my wife and I would, just the other night, we watched the most recent American Horror Stories, and we were like, this is totally horrible and freaking us out. And then we went to sleep and had bad dreams. Like, that's not surprising that that would affect my mind, that that activity affects the mind. So it's that sort of thing. Like, these things are constantly in play, body, speech, mind, activity, speech, mind. And to actually start to notice and discern, here are the things I actually want to cultivate more of, because I'm starting to get to know my mind better. I know it feels good when I do this sort of activity. I want to do more of that sort of activity. They're all sort of conjoined. Same thing with the things we want to cut out or reject. It doesn't feel good when I waste an hour a day on social media. I want to do less of that. So then we start to actually apply that in terms of the activity of our life. But it starts partly, one way to start at least, is to get to know our mind better.
Yeah, I love that. I love that whole body, speech, and mind connection. I feel the longer that I've really have been in the nutrition space and the health space and mostly focused on the physical, I've realized that there's so much more to it. Someone can eat perfectly and exercise perfectly, but if the mind and the spirit aren't in the right place, we just really won't see the results that we're looking for. And I've really become fascinated with this whole idea that there are so many different diseases and ailments that are actually really tied to some form of spiritual connection. And I just was wondering if you've seen any kind of breakthroughs or resolutions in people's symptoms through just the practice of meditation.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, I'm of two minds here because one, a lot of times people will emphasize more of the mental health as opposed to the physical health when they're talking about meditation. Oh, meditation helps me with my depression. Meditation helps me with my anxiety disorder. And it can. And the reason I'm sort of two minds is because it absolutely can. And it does not a substitute for therapy if someone needs therapy or desires therapy, that they can often work very much in conjunction. So I'm never like, oh, meditate your depression away, go off your meds. Like that's not a safe and smart thing to do. So at the same time, can it help us notice when we are going down a particular hole in our own mind around what is, you know, the thoughts that are really dragging us down? Yes, we can catch ourselves quicker because we've been meditating. We can pull ourselves out a little bit. So it can help with these sorts of things, particularly around mental health. But yeah, as we mentioned earlier, you know, I think some of these studies are really interesting around the boosting of the immune system and things like that. That I do think that if we are not holding the body in a constant state of stress, we are more able to heal and to get to know it better.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about, you know, I lived in New York first 8 years of my life and then another dozen years, like what, 20 years of my life? That's more than half. And I did notice towards the end of my stint there that my body was just being held in more of a state of stress than was healthy. And that was not actually the way I wanted it to be. Yeah. So there's also, when we were talking about discernment a moment ago, what aspects of my life do I want to cultivate more of? Which ones do I want to cut out? The more I got to look at that part of my life, the more I was able to say, oh, maybe there needs to be a change here. It's not a change that I even necessarily wanted because I'm such a city boy. But the idea of like, oh, I could live a simpler and quieter life upstate. And to actually begin to like lean into that thought process and say, you know, is this the best place for me physically? Is this the best place for me mentally? And at this point in my life, I said, you know, in terms of the things that I'm currently prioritizing, it makes more sense for me to be up there. And so these things can cause major life shifts for sure. And sometimes it does come down to just noticing what we need physically.
Interesting.
So I'm telling you guys about Heart and Soil supplements because they are amazing and I love them so much. When it comes to Heart and Soil supplements, if you aren't really that familiar with them, I would definitely recommend that you go back and listen to the interview we did with Dylan from Heart and Soil Supplements. It was such an amazing podcast. We really dived into why these animal products are so essential for our health. And on top of it all, Dylan just has such a sweet spirit. Now, when it comes to these supplements, I'm such a big fan because they are desiccated organs, meaning that we're getting these nutrients from a whole food form. This is so important because a lot of the times when we're supplementing with different vitamins and minerals, we're really only uptaking about 40% of them, just because they're in a bit of a foreign form and our body doesn't quite know how to process them. But when we get them through these whole food forms, such as these amazing organ meats, our body is so much more capable of knowing how to uptake them and utilize them. So it's just more bang for your buck and your health is just going to prosper that much more. Now, they use a unique blend of different organs to create a targeted approach to different health concerns and goals. So some of the ones that I love the very most are Heart of the Warrior and Lifeblood. These are both amazing for just helping to increase endurance and strength, recovery, and just overall exercise performance. So I really love to take these, especially in the summer months when I feel like I'm just really wearing my body down through all of the trail running and mountain biking. They just really give me that extra boost. And I definitely notice that I just feel more capable of
getting in those deep breaths and really feeling like I'm uptaking that oxygen the way it needs to be uptaken. Some other ones that I think are really amazing, they have the gut and digestion, which is going to be so great for leaky gut and just any kind of GI issues. I see such a difference when I use the skin, hair, and nails. So that one's super amazing. And they just added a new one to their list. So they just introduced her package, which I think is so in alignment with this podcast and all of you listeners. So her package is going to be a unique blend that helps with hormonal balance, menstrual dysfunction, and fertility. So this is so amazing that they're just keeping all of us females in mind and how important it really is to strengthen our endocrine system through these amazing organ meats. Now, one of my favorite things about Heart and Soil supplements is they use regenerative practices. So this means that they're good for you, they're good for the animals, and they're good for the planet. And that really just gives me chills. So head on over to Heart and Soil Supplements and use the code THEBALANCEFEMININE10 at checkout, and that will get you 10% off your supplement purchase. That's THEBALANCEFEMININE10, all lowercase, and you'll get 10% off. All right, guys, go try these out because I know you're going to love them.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, no one ever asked about that. So my mother was doing a yoga teacher training back in the late, I guess, early 70s at this point. It must've been like 1970 exactly. And as part of that, in order to graduate, this person randomly was like, you all have to do this meditation retreat with this guy, Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So she went to this meditation retreat. This is actually going to say way too much about my mother, but I think it's a good story. And she sat through, and at the end, everyone had a little interview with him. So she sat down one-on-one, and he was like, what was your experience? She was like, I didn't like it. I didn't like this meditation thing. I'm not into it. I'm just doing it because of this certification. And he laughed at her, laughed at the whole situation. She walked away, and she was so mad that he laughed at her that she came back the next weekend, sat through another whole meditation retreat just to tell him off in the interview, but then fell in love with the practice. And that's how she got meditating. And of course, she became a student of his and, you know, continued to have a really lovely teacher-student relationship for many, many years until he died some 12 years later. No, 17 years later. And my father, because he was pursuing her and she basically had moved up to that place where she had done that retreat, in order to court her, he had to go to meditation retreats as well. So it's not actually great intentions in going into it, but they really, like, once in the midst of it, fell in love with the practices and continued to do so.
Wow. So it's been a part of their lives for a while now too.
Yeah. I mean, 1970 to 2000, so it's 51 years. It's a long time.
It's interesting too, because so that meditation wasn't, I mean, it's funny because I listened to something you said the other day and I resonated with it, because you used the word mindfulness and how it's kind of become this, like, you know, this word like mindfulness is almost like, I feel like, trendy now. And it's interesting to hear you say like that it was like in the 1970s that they got into it, because for me, like, it wasn't until I was like in my mid 20s that I started hearing about meditation and everything. So they were like in it when it was the beginning, or however you want to call it, the beginning. So that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And another thing about this is it is interesting, because at this moment in time, mindfulness meditation is being offered, and totally okay that this is the case, independent of like the Buddhist philosophy and things like that. But it does come from this Buddhist tradition that's been around for 2,600 years. So there is this interesting fine line of some people will get into it and it will be a helpful tool for their life and help them continue to wake up to who they are. And there is going to probably be some section of those people who are like, and I want to actually find out where this came from, and I want to practice some of these other traditional beliefs, and I want to sort of study the teachings and things like that. And I think that is also very lovely. But yeah, I mean, they fell in love with Buddhism. Right? Like, this was pre-mindful. Like, when you went to this place, it was a Buddhist place. And until very recently, it's like, if you wanted to practice mindfulness meditation, you were going to a Buddhist center. And by recently, I mean like last decade or so. Wow. And now we're seeing this proliferation. I mean, as I mentioned, I ran a network of meditation studios in New York City that had mindfulness, but also had Vedic meditation teachers, Jewish meditation teachers, all sorts of traditions. And I think the interesting line that many of us are trying to walk in presenting these things is really representing and acknowledging the traditional while trying to make those traditional things very accessible and applicable to our modern world. Yeah. I think that's the joining. It's not like we slice it out and say, well, this is the only interesting part for people these days. Right. I think that's sort of arrogant. I think there has to be the sense of like, and here's where it comes from. And people can pursue where it comes from or not. It's totally up to them. But there's some sense of, oh, you're rooted in that tradition of 2,600 years. You know what you're talking about. So a good example, you know, I often lead mindfulness teacher trainings once a year, starting in like January. And I always tell them that like anyone can sort of give the 3 points of instruction I mentioned earlier, being in a nice posture, breathing, noticing when you get distracted, coming back to the breath. But if someone says, hey, can I lay down in meditation? The people that graduate from that program will actually know, yes, you can. And it's because the Buddha 2,600 years ago, and I'll do this in 10 seconds or less, hopefully, under the Four Noble Truths that he taught, there's the fourth, which is the Eightfold Path. Under the Eightfold Path, there's one that's known as Right Mindfulness. Under Right Mindfulness, he taught something called the Satipatthana Sutra, where he talks about the four foundations of mindfulness, the first of which is mindfulness of the body. And in that, he says, yeah, there's four postures you can use: sitting, standing, laying down, and walking. It's just there. And so it's like, yes, in a common class, if I'm sitting in a class, like, yes, you can absolutely lay down. But in my mind, I know where this actually comes from, because there's actual traditional basis for this. And there's actual logic behind why that is. So I think that's sort of the interesting thing these days, are people actually knowing about these things, or are they just sort of repeating what they might have heard elsewhere? And we don't want the traditional teachings to become sort of a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. We want people to sort of have an understanding of the original source and then to be able to speak to it from their own experience.
Interesting. Yeah. So when you, sorry, Maddie, you can go.
You can go and then I'll go.
Okay. I just, a quick question, because this is something I always wonder and struggle with. When you're meditating, do you believe that sitting in the upright position with your feet planted on the ground, like hands on your legs or however, is far more effective than if you're lying down? Like I always wonder that.
It depends on the person. And I think that's sort of when people are like, how do I get going with meditation? I often recommend that they start working with a live teacher in some format, even if it, you know, it's online, it's in a studio, whatever. Like, yeah, just so that these sorts of things can be discussed. And one could say, well, why are you laying down? And if someone's laying down because they have this really, they got into a car accident, they have a really hard time sitting upright in general, then they should absolutely be laying down, because we don't want people being masochistic and that they're just sitting there saying, I'm in pain, instead of following the breath. If someone's like, oh, you know, I get tired sometimes, and it's more of a question of like, again, I'm just sort of behind the scenes of what do I think of as a meditation teacher? I would say something along the lines of like, well, let's review the view of like the intention behind this practice, which is to wake up to our life, not to just sort of space out and like zone out, because maybe that posture without a good reason to using it might just encourage them to like literally pass out and fall asleep. Yeah. So it depends on the person and what their intention is and what they want to get out of the practice. And, you know, there's good reasons for us to actually be able to lay down. And then there's reasons that we're just sort of like, I don't want to deal with the discomfort of being in a chair because I've been in a chair all day. Maybe that's not the best reason. So it depends. I mean, it's sort of not a great answer, but I will say this, you know, I think everyone's body is different and everyone has different needs. And it's really important for people to work with someone so that they can actually understand the best posture. And if they are laying down, that's great. I would even just say maybe placing your feet on the floor so that your knees are in the air. There's even within that simple gesture, some sense of there is uprightness. There is some sense of, this isn't how I, for example, when I get in bed at night and I try and fall asleep, that's not how I'm sitting, or that's not how I'm laying down. There's some distinction in our own mind and saying, oh, this is different than bedtime, right? Mm-hmm. There's some subtle things that we can do around this if we are laying down, to remind ourselves that the intention here is not bedtime, but actually wake up time.
It's funny that I love that answer, because that's exactly what I was like trying to figure out. Because for me, my intention, like I couldn't figure out my intention. So I'd be like, oh, I'm just going to meditate, but I'll lie down. And then I end up falling asleep. I'm like, I actually like meditation, but wasn't seeing anything, because the intention of why I was like doing that wasn't there. So that's very helpful. Thank you.
So my question kind of goes along with the whole posture thing. You mentioned the sitting, laying down, standing, and walking. And I guess for me, I've always said, I always really do try and meditate, but I'm not as good as I definitely should be. And I always say that my meditation is trail running. I just feel like while I'm trail running, I really can go through all my thoughts, but then I always come back to the breath. I always leave my workout just having a much clearer view on life and like the situation at hand. And I'm just wondering, do you think that that could be a form of meditation, or am I kind of just making this up to make myself feel better?
Yeah. I'll jump in. Yes, no. So, okay. If we go back to that definition, okay, mindfulness and meditation, that's this idea that we're continuously coming back to this object of our attention. If I'm going for a run, or I'm going for a walk or something like that, there will be times where my mind just sort of goes for long periods of time. And maybe I come back to the thing, whether the thing is my feet on the ground or my breath, or if I'm walking the dog, you know, that is meditative, but it's not sort of formal meditation because I'm not repeatedly catching myself and coming back. And that's a very slight distinction, but that is a real distinction. That sense of, are you there with every footstep? If you are, yeah. And then when you get distracted, you immediately come back. That could be meditation. It's very fast-paced meditation, which is why it's often harder for people. Why do we meditate on the breath? It's already happening. Like whoever is listening to this right now, they're sitting there breathing. You know, they could just notice the breath for 30 seconds. And that is, you know, them paying mindful attention out to that particular object. And then when we get distracted, we come back. So same thing. It's just already waiting for us, which is why it's often recommended as a good starting point. And then the more we do that, the more we could, for example, do walking meditation. But in walking meditation, we are present for every footstep. And then when we get distracted, we immediately come back. Same thing. It's just a different object of our attention. So I guess the question, only you know, to be honest, whether this is meditation or not, depending on how far you drift off and whether you are actually intentionally coming back repeatedly to the object of your attention.
Okay. I love that. That's good advice.
So this is
going to start off a little slower and then
yeah.
This is going to be a very interesting question, but the breath, it has so much power in everything that we do, our being. What is it that allows us to recenter? Like, what is it about the breath that holds so much power?
Yeah. So the breath is, as I mentioned a moment ago, just waiting for us, which is great. It's, as you said, there is a lot of power to it. There is a lot of, it's constantly fresh, right? It's constantly new. It's not stagnant. If I, you know, put a Buddha statue down on my desk and I said, I'm going to pay constant attention to it. And I, every time I get distracted, I come back to my attention on the Buddha statue. That's fine. But it doesn't feel as fresh and new within each moment. So there's something very beautiful about the breath. And for people who are brand new to meditation, they could even start by counting each breath. And the way that we would do that is by noticing the in-breath, the out-breath. And there's a slight gap at the end of that out-breath where there's just space. That can be a moment of real distraction for many people. But in that gap here, we would just silently say to ourselves, one, another breath enters and then leaves the body, two. And we could do that until we either hit 10 cycles of the breath, at which point we start over at one, or we get distracted, at which point we acknowledge it, we come back and we start again at one. And this isn't to get us super competitive and see how quickly or how far up the ladder we can get, but just a sense of keeping us rooted and acknowledging each breath as a unique act, because that's what they are. It's just always fresh, it's always unique. And it's just such a steady, constant thing that we don't need to do. We don't need to produce anything in this moment. We don't have to fix the breath. We don't have to change it. All we have to do is just relax with what's already happening, which is great training, I think, for a lot of other parts of our life.
Yeah.
I love that because I feel like when we look at like Chinese medicine, kind of the root of all like pain and disease is kind of the stagnancy. So kind of having something that's constant, but also not stagnant, it's continuously flowing and changing to come back to. So it's really awesome.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Wow. I know we kind of have to wrap up here, but I want to ask you, like, if you could offer like our listeners and just anyone, any piece of advice around you know, if they're just starting to get into the practice of meditation, they're struggling with it. It's kind of one of those things, like, you know, when you hear like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. And like, so in my head, like, what piece of advice could you offer that would be helpful?
Yeah. I guess one thing that I didn't touch on probably enough in this particular conversation is this core Buddhist belief, but also I would say experience for people who meditate, whether they are Buddhist or not, is that when we start meditating, we have these glimpses, these moments that we're not so lost in our head. We're not so lost in all these anxiety-producing thoughts. And that experience is one of feeling a sense of wholeness, of completeness in that moment. In some traditions, we would call this basic goodness that is fundamental. It's inherent to who we are when we get out of our own way. And the goodness isn't good versus bad, like we're talking about before, purity versus impurity, none of that. It's a sense of just that wholeness. We're fundamentally whole and okay in that moment. Now, the reason I said this is Buddhist belief is because according to Buddhism, that's fundamentally who we are. That's just that our actual natural state. And then we can cover it over with our confusion and neurosis. So for anyone who's interested in meditation, yes, can it help us with stress? Yes. It's the guy who wrote a book on meditation anxiety. You know, Take Back Your Mind. It's nice about that, you know, but I think within that, I was like, that's step one. Step two is that once we start to let go of some of these stressful thoughts, there's this realm of peace, calm, and goodness that's just waiting for us and that we can discover it. And I write in that book that it's sort of, as far as I can tell, after however many decades of doing these practices, the entirety of the path is like step one, we discover this moment of goodness for ourselves. It's not like Lodro telling you that this exists or something. It's like you just discover it yourself in your practice. Step two is that we then start to develop confidence in it and a relationship to it. Now, it's not that we act from it all the time, but we start to catch more glimpses of it, catch more glimpses in our post-meditation experience, the rest of our waking hours. And then step three is that we would actually then start to live through the lens of that, as opposed to the lens of our neurosis, the lens of I'm not good enough. So I think that's really the primary benefit of meditation. All, you know, sleeping better, it sounds wonderful to many people, but that's like step one. And then the more we dig into this, more we're like, well, maybe I can actually transform my view of who I am. I'm not fundamentally messed up, but I'm actually fundamentally good.
Interesting. Very powerful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Yeah. Now I need to go do meditation.
I know, me too. Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This has been such a great conversation and learning experience for us and our audience. So I really appreciate it.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was nice meeting you.
Yeah. Nice meeting you. Bye, Lodro.